I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. I'm back from my trip to Dallas, where last week it was my honor to deliver the keynote address and share my story at the National MS Society's Dallas on the Move luncheon. It was a great event, and I want to pass along my congratulations to everyone who worked so hard to make it a success. After speaking at the luncheon, I flew to Chicago, where I was invited to speak at the 4th Annual National Caregiving Conference. Caregiving doesn't come with a handbook, and I think I learned how to be a good caregiver for my wife by first making every mistake possible. And if I can share some of the caregiving insights that I eventually gained and help someone avoid making those mistakes, I'm always going to take advantage of those opportunities when they come along. So today I'm at home, primarily to check in on my wife. And then tomorrow, I'm heading to Atlanta to attend the National MS Society's Leadership Conference. And I'm really looking forward to being with so many of the heroes in the battle to solve the riddle of MS. You know, each week on Real Talk MS, I try to include an interview with a difference maker, someone whose efforts are making a real difference in the lives of people and families affected by MS. And I'm excited about the MS Society's Leadership Conference, because I'll be with about 500 difference makers. And while I'm there, I may even have an announcement to make about the Real Talk MS podcast. So stay tuned. Just in case I do, you'll be amongst the first to know. My guest today is Dr. Mary Bailey, a neurologist specializing in MS care at the Mandel Center for Multiple Sclerosis in Hartford, Connecticut. And we're talking about some of the things that people might want to think about as relapsing-remitting MS transitions to secondary progressive MS. Since about 80% of the people living with relapsing-remitting MS will experience that transition to secondary progressive, I think it's an important conversation to have. But before we get to that conversation with Dr. Mary Bailey, there are a few other things that you should know about. Yesterday was Veterans Day, so I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our veterans, along with all of the men and women serving today, for their service and sacrifice. You may not know it, but the prevalence of MS among members of the military returning from Vietnam and the Gulf War indicates that there may be some sort of connection between military combat service and multiple sclerosis. That's one of the reasons why, since 2009, the Department of Defense has invested in MS research through the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program, or CDMRP. And that research benefits not only members of the service, but everyone living with MS. The DoD's MS research program fills research gaps by focusing on funding high-risk, high-reward projects that other federal agencies, like the National Institutes of Health, may not fund. Earlier this year, I shared one of the MS research studies funded by the CDMRP that looked at using reprogrammed neural stem cells to treat MS. The study showed some encouraging results, so that work continues. I also told you about a strategic partnership that was announced this year between the National MS Society and the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. Strategic partnerships serve to accelerate the MS Society's impact, and this partnership with the Department of Veterans Affairs is designed to accelerate delivery and ensure access to services and support for the 70,000 U.S. military veterans who are living with MS. You can find an entire section of the MS Society's website devoted to information and resources specifically aimed at former armed services members, and I'll include a link to that information in today's show notes. My advice to other caregivers is to reach out and get as much help as you possibly can. That advice comes from Whit Conant, a caregiver for his wife, Margie, who's living with MS. November is National Family Caregivers Month, and I came across Whit and Margie's story in a short video that was produced by the National MS Society. The video gives us what I think is a very authentic peek at some of the things that couples affected by MS go through every day. And it also provides some excellent tips on how both partners can best manage their relationship when one of them becomes the other's caregiver. The video is definitely worth your attention. You can find it on YouTube, and I'll include a link to that video in today's show notes. For the past 18 years, a nonprofit organization called First Ascents has offered free outdoor activities, community building, and skills development to young adults with cancer. Providing individualized care, medical attention, and the opportunity to connect with other young adult oncology patients, First Ascents features week-long local and international adventures that feature activities like climbing, kayaking, and surfing. Last year, First Ascents expanded their program to include outdoor adventures designed for young adults living with MS. And those programs were so successful and so well received that this coming year in 2020, they're expanding to 7 outdoor adventures for young adults living with MS. Now, these outdoor experiences are offered at no charge, and the first one is happening in January. Well, believe it or not, that's right around the corner, so I wanted to give you a heads up about it today. And if you're between the ages of 18 and 45 and you're living with MS, I hope you consider participating, because this January, from the 20th to the 26th, First Ascents is offering its first skiing program geared specifically for beginners. The program will take place at Crested Butte, Colorado, which offers some of the most gorgeous skiing in Colorado. And First Ascents is partnering with Adaptive Sports Center to ensure that this skiing adventure will be an amazing one that you'll never forget. And I'll remind you again that, like all of First Ascents outdoor adventures, this program is free of charge. I hope you'll check out the eligibility details and start the program application process at the First Ascents website, and you'll find a link to the online program inquiry in today's show notes. Last week, I gave you a heads up about the Progress in MS Research Live Update 2019 that was being live streamed by MS Research Australia. The research update featured 4 outstanding MS experts. Dr. Ellen Mowry of Johns Hopkins University explained MS risk factors. Professor Giancarlo Castello Branco of the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm talked about research in remyelination. Dr. Tanuja Chitnis of Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital discussed patient-centered research and the importance of self-reported outcomes in MS research. And Dr. Chris Dwyer from the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health and the Royal Melbourne Hospital talked about the evolution of MS treatment in Australia and gave us a peek at what's coming next. The individual presentations were followed by a panel discussion, and if you missed catching the hour-long live stream, I'll include a link to the video replay in today's show notes, and I hope you consider it required viewing. I've had some listener requests to discuss minority participation in MS research. It's an important topic, and we touched on it earlier this year when my guest was Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, a neurologist and MS specialist with a strong interest in better understanding the course of MS in ethnic minority populations and in increasing diversity in clinical research. Well, as I said, I think this is a really important topic. So while I'm researching new developments in minority participation in MS research, I want to revisit part of my conversation with Dr. Mitzi Williams. One of the challenges that's typically faced in clinical trials is trying to recruit minority participation. Yet, if you're hoping to come out of a clinical trial with a treatment that's going to be effective for the diverse population living with multiple sclerosis, well, then having that diversity represented in your clinical trial becomes really important. Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams is a neurologist and MS specialist with a strong interest in better understanding the course of MS in ethnic minority populations, and in increasing diversity in clinical research. Dr. Williams is also the author of MS Made Simple, The Essential Guide to Understanding Your Multiple Sclerosis Diagnosis. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Williams.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
In introducing you, I mentioned that one of your interests is in better understanding the course of MS in ethnic minority populations. So does that imply that the disease course might be different within minority populations?
So that's a great question, and one that we encounter very regularly for those of us who are interested in research. I think the honest answer is we don't really know. So there is a body of research that's really begun to accumulate over the past 10 years that suggests that MS may present differently in ethnic minority populations, including African Americans and people of Hispanic or Latino descent, in terms of the age ranges, also possibly in terms of the symptoms that may occur when this disease presents. And also, there are some studies that suggest the course of disease may be worse, particularly for African Americans. And a couple of different ways that that data has been presented include MRIs, which suggest there may be more lesions in African American patients, as well as studies of disability that suggest there may be walking disability that occurs earlier than in their Caucasian counterparts. I think the difficulty with a lot of this data is that much of it is what we call retrospective. So that basically means that we take a group of people and we look backwards to see how they did over time versus looking at data prospectively, which is how many of our clinical trials work. The way that data is collected that way is that we basically start everybody at the same point, put everyone on a pretty level playing field, and then we look forward to see how people do if they're receiving the same care. And so some of the issues with the data that suggest that African Americans may do worse is that we don't have that data where everybody starts on that level playing field. So it's unclear if it is more of a genetic basis or if there may be issues with access to care that may be causing people to do worse, or maybe access to different resources, including a neurologist or an MS specialist. So the honest answer is there are some suggestions that MS is worse, but we really don't know the real answer.
And that really underscores the importance of creating more diverse groups of people to participate in these studies so we can get some of those answers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think it's very important to educate the community at large about the importance of clinical trials and also about how clinical trials and other research studies are conducted. You know, certainly there is a history of discrimination within the healthcare system, and there are numerous real life examples of that in the history of research here, particularly in the U.S. But clinical trials are done very differently than they were done even 50 or 60 years ago. And there are lots of safeguards in place. There are ethical committees that look at the studies and the protocols. And so there are lots of things in place to make sure that everyone is getting good quality care and that everyone is being treated equally. So I think it's important to educate the community about that and the importance of participation.
Do you have any thoughts on what the best way or some of the best ways might be to do that sort of outreach? Because I agree with you. I think it's so important. How do we make that happen?
So I think there are a couple of different approaches. I think that certainly many people are very engaged in social media. And so I think that that provides a medium to gain access and to provide education to a large group of people simultaneously that may not have been able to be reached traditionally with some of our traditional face-to-face programs. I think that also there are opportunities with some of our advocacy groups and other people who are very interested in increasing diversity in research to partner together to provide different educational programs. I know that personally I have done several programs across the country focused on looking at MS and ethnic minority populations. And as a part of that, we also do a lot of discussion around research and the importance of clinical trial participation. I think that there are also opportunities for other organizations, especially ones that are spearheaded by people living with MS, to tell us as providers what information is needed to help with education. There are some partnerships with different entities, including myself, other organizations, as well as the Accelerated Care Project and some members from the iConquer MS committee, to talk about ways to disseminate education for not just people living with MS, but also for healthcare providers, because there certainly could be some issues related to bias on the part of providers who are telling people about research studies. So I think that we have to approach it from both angles, via disseminating education through electronic or video means, as well as in-person education, and partnering together not just with researchers and scientists and with companies, but also with those who are personally affected by MS, to make sure that we're providing education that is useful and providing the information that's needed.
You know, moving from clinical research to clinical treatment, I've often heard other researchers say that cultural differences within some ethnic minority populations can often delay when or even how someone who's a member of one of those populations might seek treatment for any chronic condition, including MS. Has that been your observation as well?
Absolutely. And of course, each individual is different, but certainly there are some trends that I've seen in certain populations. I deal primarily with a very large African-American population in Atlanta, which is where my practice is based and where I live. And so very often, treatment decisions are family decisions. And so there have been instances where a person has come in, we've talked about different treatment options, and maybe they went home, talked to a family member or a group of family members, and the people that they confer with don't think that's a good idea. And that may delay treatment, especially if those members who are particularly involved in care cannot attend the doctor's appointment and kind of go over the data and things like that. I think another barrier or potential barrier sometimes may be religious practices, although oftentimes people pray in conjunction with going to the physician. Sometimes people also look at treatment of a disease as admission to having a disease, and they want to not claim, so to speak, is one of the terms that's used, certain disease processes, and that may also delay treatment. And so I think it's very important for us as healthcare providers to make sure that we try to understand the different barriers or different, aspects that lead someone to start treatment and help lead to their treatment decisions, and that we certainly don't downplay or disregard those ideas, but to make sure we're trying to incorporate those into the treatment plan to make sure that people understand the importance of treatment and that, everyone's on the same page for treatment goals.
I also want to mention that there's a replay of a webinar about minority participation in MS research that Dr. Williams did with the MS Association of America and the Accelerated Cure Project. And I'll include a link to that webinar replay in today's show notes as well. When an MS diagnosis transitions from relapsing remitting to secondary progressive MS, it can come as a shock. It probably means a new conversation with your neurologist. And my guest today, neurologist and MS care specialist Dr. Mary Bailey, shares some of the things about secondary progressive MS that you might want to keep in mind when you have that conversation. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Mary Bailey. Dr. Mary Bailey is a neurologist specializing in MS care at the Mandel Center for Multiple Sclerosis in Hartford, Connecticut, and we're talking about MS progression. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you for having me.
I guess we can start right at the beginning. What does it mean when we talk about the spectrum of MS?
That's a great question. I think that the spectrum of MS describes all the different variations of MS and its presentations. MS we typically think of as having different subtypes, relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis being the most common, and 80% of patients with relapsing MS go on to develop a secondary progressive MS subtype that is more characterized by progressive disease, and we think of that as having progressive decline, typically in mobility and in some cases in cognition.
So I was about to ask you for a good definition of secondary progressive MS, but perhaps you just gave me one, actually.
Yeah, I think that when we think of secondary progressive MS, I think that as doctors, and our patients need to think of it in a broad context. because it's not necessarily a disease that is characteristic of just those who are above the age of 60 and in the later years of their disease process. It's anybody really who is experiencing signs of disease progression. So I tell my patients to think about, are you experiencing mobility decline, where you're having a decrease in your walking stamina? Are you able to go a less of a distance from month to month, year to year? Is your thinking declining? And if that's happening, even if you're in your 40s and you can still be having relapses superimposed on that, then that is a sign of a progressive nature to your disease process.
We've seen that different people, as their disease progresses and they transition from relapsing remitting to secondary progressive, that happens on a very individualized timetable. Different people progress at a different rate. Do we understand why that happens?
I think that's a very good question. I don't think we fully understand why each individual MS patient does what they do. However, I think that the earlier that you are afflicted with MS and the earlier that you have the onset, and the heavier your disease burden, then the more likely it is that you may exhibit signs of progressive disease earlier. And this isn't a rule. Every patient, as we know, is different. And sometimes there is no rhyme or reason to what people experience.
Speaking of no rhyme or reason, are there any changes that people living with MS can expect when their diagnosis is transitioning from relapsing remitting to secondary progressive?
That's a great question. When somebody is diagnosed with secondary progressive MS, I tell them that this should not feel like a big change. I actually don't want them to feel like this is sort of a big life-altering new diagnosis for them. I think that what it should just do is bring a name to some symptoms that they have been experiencing for quite some time, and bring a different focus to the symptoms they're experiencing, so that some better care can be given to the symptoms and perhaps better attention to whether or not the treatment that they're currently on is the correct one, or does it need to be changed to something else.
So someone who's been living with relapsing remitting MS and they find themselves transitioning to secondary progressive MS, how should their MS care be changing along with their changes?
In regards to how MS care should be changing, I don't necessarily think that change is a good word. I think evolving should be a word that we use, because I think this is such the subtypes of MS can be so easily sort of blended together. And what I say to patients is, you know, we're going to always be working on your symptomatic care. And, you know, that isn't going to change. But when it comes down to sort of looking at what may help progressive disease, you're thinking about treatment choices and whether or not the treatment that maybe you are on in the earlier stages of your disease, is that the most appropriate choice later on?
Maybe we should touch upon care that patient is receiving outside of the clinic setting, someone at home, as their disease evolves and their needs evolve. How does the role of their family caregiver, their internal family social support system, how does that need to evolve too?
Absolutely. I think that the role of the caregiver and one support network is so critical, especially in multiple sclerosis, because I always say that this is a disease that really affects the whole family and the whole unit of the patient. But I think that the caregiver also needs to be given tools to learn how to deal with these changes. And this is something that the healthcare provider needs to help the patient and the caregiver with as well. So for example, with my patients, I do ask about access within the home. Just things like, are there stairs? And is it difficult to navigate within the home? We have to think about ramps and, stair lifts and different things to put in the home to just make it more accessible for the patient. And I make sure to connect my patients with social workers and different agencies that can aid with this process. But it becomes much of a more a team caretaking experience on the healthcare provider's part as well, because a lot of different therapies and care needs need to be put in place in order for that patient and the family to have the best quality of life.
Well, I want to thank you so much for kind of taking us through what that MS progression means and the evolving needs, both in terms of clinic and at home evolving needs that that patient may develop over time, and how their care team can best come together and collaborate for the best solutions. And thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. A few of you have asked me how you can go about sharing specific episodes of the podcast. Well, I've tried to make it as easy as I can. If you want to share this particular episode with someone, just send them a link to realtalkms.com/115. That's realtalkms.com/115. And they'll be able to click on that link and listen to the very episode you're listening to right now. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast, you might want to do that today. It's free, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can find Real Talk MS wherever you find your favorite podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Pandora. Or you can visit the Apple App Store or Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. And if you happen to have an Amazon Echo or Echo Dot at home, well, you can just say, Alexa, enable the Real Talk MS podcast. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.